Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast, conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. If you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast, now's a good time to do that. Subscribe, follow, rate, review, share, repeat. Let's say you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts. Head over to Spotify, follow the podcast there, and then download five other platforms. Do the same there. Every little bit helps. And the Aaron Bender Podcast is now on YouTube.
Yay.
Okay, that's enough. Exclusive content you cannot get anywhere else. Head to AaronBender.com for all the links. Before we get to my conversation with TV reporter Lori Lizarraga, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of two girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job, then lost it. A year and a half ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I could learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, self-care, patience, and understanding. Lori Lizarraga is a TV news reporter who just finished a 2-year stint at KUSA 9 News in Denver. Prior to that, she worked at KGET in Bakersfield. On her way out of Colorado, she wrote an article for Denver news website Westword.com called Latinx. 9 News got rid of 3 Latino reporters this past year, including me. She writes about what she describes as oppressive policies and actions, including using illegal instead of undocumented. One reporter wasn't allowed to cover immigration stories unless she revealed on air her immigration status. Lori says she wasn't even allowed to wear her hair in a bun with a middle part, as she's seen and worn as a Mexican and Ecuadorian woman all her life. And a week after, she and her colleagues presented a plan to improve the station's coverage of last year's racial justice movement, she was put on an improvement plan. If you want to read the article before this conversation with Lori, hit pause, go to the show notes, and click on the link. Then come on back and listen to Lori's thought process going into writing the article, concerns about what she's done to her career, and conversations with her siblings and immigrant parents before and since the article came out. Now, Lori showed up on my radar because a bunch of journalists I follow were reposting her article, shouting her out, all that kind of stuff. So I started our chat asking what kind of feedback or reaction she expected from the article and how she's dealing with it.
Actually, interestingly enough, was more prepping myself in the days leading up to the piece being published for no reaction. Just in case nothing happened, I didn't want to be disappointed or really let down, because it did take a lot for me to write this piece and bring myself, not just to put the words on the paper, but to actually put it in front of the world. It's risky to write what I wrote and to share those honest and intimate details of the last 2 years of my experience in my newsroom in Denver. So I was more than anything just trying to prepare myself for the possibility of this just being one small push of a really big issue up a hill, and allowing it to be just that for maybe someone who has another experience and feels empowered to share it when they come behind me. Or something like that. So the day that it did come out and I woke up to people already messaging me and following me on Twitter and tagging me, that was enough in itself to be like caught off guard, let alone what the last 10 days have been. I mean, I could not have prepared myself for the type of engagement, for people to even make it from the first word of the article down to the last. When people are quoting paragraphs that are much lower in the piece than they are at the top, I mean, that is not lost on me that I don't always make it to the end of an article when I'm reading. So the fact people are reading this at all from start to finish or anywhere that they've stopped, just opening it up means so much to me. And I have learned that, you know, a lot of people are doing that. And not only that, they're engaging, they're sharing with me their shared experiences, unfortunately, be it from former, you know, 9 News employees or just journalists of color in the industry, period. And it has been incredible to watch the local community come alongside the piece and demand better. And to also just watch it also take off from the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. And beyond that, it's really been all totally unexpected and not at all what I wasted time preparing for.
How much time did it take for you to, A, decide to even write that piece, and then B, hoping that it's going to be read by at least a few people? You want to make sure that all your I's are dotted and T's are crossed. How long did it take for you to write it, edit it, and decide, okay, this is the final finished piece?
I think, and I've shared this, you know, with a couple of people now, that it was really initial, and you know, you learn from the piece that it was really, it happened fast, that I was concerned about what I was seeing, and red flags were going up really fast. I was fortunate enough to have a great experience in my first newsroom. So all of this was quite a surprise to me.
And the first newsroom was Bakersfield, KGET?
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so I say I knew pretty early within the 2 years that I was there that I would say something. And the proof was in the pattern that I had to, but I knew really early that I would start collecting receipts and doing my due diligence just in case I ever did want to bring it to light. I didn't know I would do it this soon for sure. But in terms of the things that kept happening, just even in the last few months of my contract, it was almost like the timing is too right. And it's too important to do this now to wait. And I knew that that meant that I could potentially be risking what I do next, which was sort of why I wanted to wait, maybe, you know, a few years down the road when you're more established type of thing. But I could be talking about a newsroom that no longer, you know, exists. And I don't know that it would be fair. And it certainly, I don't think, would have resonated the same.
Right.
So it was quite important to me to, once I knew what my end date would be, to really start considering, okay, you knew you would write something. You knew you would say something. Now it's about timing. Do you do it now or do you wait? Like I said, I think too many things were happening for me to wait. And I knew that. And I decided, you know, I think about 6 weeks out from my contract that I for sure would say something and I would write something. And now figuring out where that would be, how it would be, what it would look like, that all came really in the last weeks of my contract. And I wrote it. I was out of my contract on March 5th. I was moving and leaving Denver for a week after that. And then I wrote the piece, I would say, in a solid 3 days when I got back from
Wow.
Denver, came Yeah. home to Texas. And I had, you know, been taking notes and, you know, keeping all my receipts, like I said, and I had just an abundance of stuff to go through to figure out what's important and what should I put in and what should I not. But I mean, yeah, from the time that I started writing words on the paper to when I turned it in and was like, final draft, like I can't touch it anymore. Don't let me touch it. It really was like a week. And thank God for Westward, who was working with me so well and knowing that it was quite an emotional toll to write it in the first place. They worked with me just so incredibly and gave me up until just the very last second to dot the, you know, I's and cross the T's. But once it was out of my hands, I was really relieved because I knew I was going to change my mind like at any minute. So I was happy that it didn't take too much time in terms of, you know, starting it and actually turning it in.
Let's talk about the platform. You talk about westward.com. That's where Latinx appeared, that article that you wrote, the column that you wrote. Why that platform? Why not just, okay, I've got an Instagram, I've got a Facebook, I've got my own platforms?
I really mulled over where to put it and got a lot of advice, you know, to use potentially like a blog space or to affiliate with, you know, no publication, to affiliate with some other local publications that trend to be more Latino, you know, viewership or to have more of a Black community buy-in. I considered a lot of different things, but what I knew about Westward in the Denver local area is that they are really generous with allowing people to have a free space to do an opinion piece like this. Mm-hmm. And my biggest fear was that if I went to any publication and asked to share, that I would have a heavy hand in what they would permit me to say. And I would understand that 100%, but I knew two things for sure. I wanted it to be in my own words, and I didn't want to be interviewed for it. I wanted it to write how I wrote it, and I wanted it to appear exactly the way I handed it in,
right.
You know, outside of copy editing. So that was really important to me. And when I did strike a conversation with Patty Calhoun, the editor over at Westward, I mean, she was extremely receptive to the possibility of, you know, no heavy hands on a piece that matters a lot to you. I trust you. As long as you can provide the background for some of the things you're saying, let's do our due diligence, you know, on our side. But otherwise, we're really going to give you this space to say what it is you want to say in 1500 words, more or less. And that's what swayed the ultimate decision. It was such a good, easy conversation with them out the gate. And I knew if I did put it on my own platforms, that could work for sure. I truly believe that that would have worked, but they have a reach that I don't have in terms of the local Denver area. And I wanted it to get to the community. That's what it's always been about, was for the community, for speaking out this truth and making sure that they knew that they were being impacted by this, whether they knew it or not. And if they had a larger reach to that community, I wanted access to that.
We'll get to more serious stuff, but I do want to find out, as somebody who teaches broadcast journalism and also kind of teaches some digital journalism, how difficult was it to turn off your broadcast news writing brain and crank out 1500 words?
You know, I had only two people read it before it went, you know, out of my hands to Westword. It was my sister and my boyfriend. My boyfriend's also an on-air reporter. And my sister is just, you know, a great writer, but she's been in marketing. She's a mom and I trust her. But I didn't have like a writer like looking at it, which in hindsight, I'm like, maybe that would have been a good idea. Danny on one hand said, you know, you sound like you're speaking on air when I read this piece. And my sister said I didn't. So I don't actually know if I was able to turn it off necessarily, or if I just don't truly know how else to write except the way that I wrote it. Yeah. I've had questions like that of you know, was it difficult? It really was just an in my own words piece. And so that's what I committed to, was just, I want you to kind of hear my tone when I write. I wanted it to be portrayed that it was me speaking, but in the fairest and most professional way that I could, while still showing like some essence of personality. Right. That's really what I was trying to do. But in terms of taking my broadcast self out of it, I don't know if I accomplished that. It's 50-50. So I don't know. You tell me.
Well, no, I love when broadcast journalists don't just do broadcast, but also do digital or do print, because it's an easy read. For most of the time, it's an easy read because we just write the way we talk.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to something you mentioned when talking about kind of working up to the piece, the timeline going into the piece. You were like, well, I don't know if maybe I should wait a few years until I'm more established to write something like this, because it's generally regarded as career threatening if you talk about your former or current employer. How much of that went into the decision? Just kind of explore that a little bit.
I mean, it was the barrier that made the decision so hard. I mean, that point of what I risked and if I would prematurely end my career as a journalist in broadcast, that was the barrier that held me back, because speaking up for my community was a no-brainer. Speaking up for the journalist coming behind me, easy. It's what I wanted to do. And it's why I fought the fights I fought in the newsroom for 2 years, uncomfortably so, and often at my expense, was for the journalists coming behind me and for the community always. The only thing that made me afraid was the risk of people feeling like I'm a liability. And I would understand that. It is the only reason that I felt, let's wait, perhaps. And all of the advice that I got in the weeks leading up to putting something out was, if not just flat out don't do this, it was like, be really thoughtful before you do this, you know, so like no endorsements whatsoever. The people who know me knew that they were not going to talk me off of this ledge, but I was seeking advice because I wanted like some buy-in from someone. And I really did get it from the people who love me, because they knew, you know, I needed to hear that support, but I really got it from my older sister. It was a month out from my contract. I was pretending like I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was stressed and I was having lots of conversations where essentially I wasn't getting the advice I wanted. So I was acting torn, you know? And I came home, she just had a baby in November. So 4-month-old, and I landed in Dallas like really late, close to midnight, expecting everyone to be asleep. And she's up with her baby. And I'm like, thank God he's being terrible tonight, because I need you to be awake. I can't sleep. I'm so like wrecked over what I should do. And it's getting to the point where it's getting close. I need to decide. And and start moving forward one way or the other. And I just told her, Christy, I don't know. I still don't know what I'm going to do with this piece. And she just skipped no beats and said, of course, you know what you're going to do. You're going to say something. You always knew you would say something, and you wouldn't be who you are if you didn't, and you wouldn't be happy down the road if you didn't, and you would regret it. You would look back and regret it. So of course, you know, you're going to say something. And from that night on, I was like, permission to move forward. Thank you for reminding me who I am. That si se puede spirit. You're right. I did always know I would say something. So let's not go back on that now. And let's not waste any more time or energy pretending that we're not going to do this. Let's just now focus on the where and the when and how. And that really was, you know, the permission I needed to move forward.
Did you talk at all with the two other Latina journalists who were let go from 9 News prior to releasing the piece?
Very much so. In the weeks leading up, it was my hope that it would be a very comprehensive story between me and several people, not just Sonia, not just Kristen, or the other two gentlemen who are in the piece. At one point, the piece was slated to have something like 7 or 8 different sources.
Oh, wow.
From within the newsroom, former, you know, employees, and other community sources. One by one, as the weeks got closer, I wasn't the only one experiencing cold feet, and rightfully so. It's a terrifying thing to put your name on something like this, especially when we don't know how it's going to be received. Now we do. So I'm sure there'd be more buy-in if I decided to like go in for round 2. But, you know, at the time, the risks you take are the future of your career, the roof over your head, your salary, your, you know, ability to be reliable in the community if you're a community leader. So a lot of people one by one, you know, decided that the risks were not worth taking. And I completely understood, but it was very time consuming to have those conversations, you know, be trying to encouraging people while also trying to make sure like I was staying encouraged as well. But of course, ultimately, the people who are in the piece, these were contributions that were really agonized over. We agonized over every single word. I mean, that's the truth of it. We really did. Every single word in quotes was conversations on the phone, emails back and forth, making sure that we got it right and were careful, especially for Sonia, what she risked, you know, of talking about her status. That's not a small thing. So we were incredibly careful. And of course, nobody was named, mentioned, or included in that piece who was not fully aware when it was coming out and exactly what their wording would be and how they would be included. And to the extent that each person is included is what they were comfortable with.
Has the feedback to them, if you've talked with them, has the feedback to them been similar to what you've experienced?
I don't know that there's a day now that I have not been on the phone with one, both of them at separate times or at the same time. I mean, like, yeah. So we're like constantly each other's ears now. And yes, they have been extremely well received, as they should be. They have been completely empowered during this time, which I've loved to see as a result of this. When people are talking about the courage it took to do the piece for me, they're also including, and rightfully so, Kristen and Sonia and the two gentlemen who spoke in the piece as community leaders, which they are, and including them in that all encompassing, this is courageous, thanks for doing this. And I really do appreciate that, because it did make it easier to come forward, having their buy-in to the extent that each of them could.
You said your boyfriend is also on the air. What kind of feedback has he gotten?
You know, it's been nice to hear how far it's gone through him. Because people are writing him, asking him to be the delivery boy of messages, you know, relay to her that we've read this. I've had a similar experience in newsrooms past. Whatever it may be, a lot of community has come around him and me as a result. And I really appreciate that people who know him or know my family or know my, you know, good friends have been pouring in those messages to make sure that it gets to me. Because, I mean, every single one, I'm truly being so honest, is worth its weight in gold right now. To feel so well received has made every single day so much easier, because I'm still nervous and I still, you know, get scared thinking about what doors may have closed as a result of this. So that support and that encouragement, it's not lost on me. Every single message, every single text, every single delivery boy message that makes my, that makes it to me, it matters. It matters to me a lot.
What about those doors that have opened perhaps in the last week and a half, 2 weeks?
That is so completely unexpected. And my God, if I could tell myself, 2 weeks ago, like, do this just for the doors this will open in terms of just having a conversation like this. I mean, that is worth it so much to me, because it has made me part of a larger conversation that's so important about diversity, representation, equity, and empowerment in newsrooms. And while that's something I've always been passionate about, clearly, it's not necessarily something that I got to be part of the dialogue on. And I'm really grateful that that's now where I get to turn my attention to, of let's talk about what I went through, but let's also talk about the ways that this is rampant in our industry as a whole. Across the country, I have received so much support, but also people commiserating and saying, I resonate with that so much. It really triggered me because it reminds me of X, Y, and Z. And that is a larger conversation that's very much happening. And I'm really, really glad I get to be a part of that. There are people who are creating now the piece and putting it into their diversity, equity, and inclusion training. There are other news organizations who have told me that the piece is now required reading for their employees. There are companies who would like me to come and turn the piece into something that I can speak into the lives of their, employees. That to me is incredible, that people who want to are taking it as a learning opportunity, because that's just the educational portion of it. I didn't anticipate, but that is really like something that I take as one of the largest wins of this whole thing.
The conversations you're having, however, don't necessarily keep the lights on right now. How concerned are you that, okay, I can have all these conversations, but how about you hire me? How about you give me a job?
So true. Thank you. It's that you're right. I always intended on taking a break after 9 in the last 2 years. That's what I tend on doing between my contracts. Anyway, this is a very fast paced, high stress job. So yeah. I already intended on not being able to keep my own lights on for a little bit. luckily I have a lot of family. I'm one of five. So if I just bounce around to each one of them for like a couple weeks, I'm pretty good for like half a year. So, I've got some wiggle room here, but you're right. It doesn't pay what I would need to continue my life and, have my own space again. For example, I did have to leave Denver the week after my contract was done, because if you don't have a salary, you can't pay rent. I mean, right. That's just the reality. So luckily for me, what this has done is open the opportunity to be someone who, if you do want me to come and speak about what I have lived and how I can impart that on you, that comes with a price. And we're making sure to work that out as we speak.
I want to find out, because in talking with some of my friends in journalism and in sports, in media, who are Hispanic, they are Mexican-American, they are a part of the Latin community, they talk about how some of the biggest haters of Latin journalists are other Latin journalists. How has the feedback been? And I keep saying feedback throughout this entire podcast. I'm just going to call this episode feedback.
Call it feedback.
Yes, <sir. laughs>
if you don't, I won't listen.
So I'm wondering, though, what has been the reaction from Latino media as a whole? I certainly saw, I wasn't following you on Instagram. I saw you because some people on my timeline.
You weren't following me on Instagram?
wasn't. Am now. People like Jonathan Gonzalez from NBC4 here in Los Angeles. I think on his Instagram was the first time I saw your piece and his reaction to it. I've seen a lot of positive reaction and encouraging reaction. What about you?
Only that. Truly only that. I don't know if I have a filter on right now on Twitter that's keeping those haters out, because they're normally there with a vengeance. But really, honestly, I have only gotten extreme support. Unfortunately, what I will say is I have gotten just a shocking number of people who say same, and I didn't expect that. And I certainly don't want that, but that's what I think is really uniting about it, is too few of us speak up, but so many of us are having these experiences. And because we are just happy to be in the room, we have permitted this to go on without saying something. And I'll say too, it's hard to know if how you're being treated really is unfair when it's been happening for so long. You almost get to a point where you're like, well, is it that bad? That's what I went through in writing the piece and sitting down to do it. I actually was like, do I even have a story? You start to make yourself believe that it's not as bad as it is. So I think we permit our own selves to let people get away with this and perpetuate it. And instead, what this has done from a lot of messages that I've gotten is encourage people to strike up a conversation in their own newsrooms in regards to problems they've brought up in the past or things they've never had the courage to address, but now they feel empowered to do so. It's just a matter of like shining a light on, you are allowed to be not okay with this treatment and you should go do something about it in the capacity that you can. I have gotten nothing but support about that because we do understand that it's new for Latino journalists to be in the room and to be elevated to the ranks, you know, in any newsroom across the country. We know we're not the majority in newsrooms in America. We're well aware of that. And we know that we have to earn our stripes and perhaps work a little harder in order to get to those places that our white counterparts are going. So nobody wants to be the person who speaks out for themselves in this way that risks so much, because you really do make yourself, who is already not being valued as much as your colleagues, even less desirable. And what this is doing is reminding us that every single person in every single newsroom is as valuable as the next. And nobody, even if I'm not the best journalist in the world, because I'm not saying that I am, but nobody deserves to be treated like that.
And asking this, of course, as a 44-year-old white man who's been in media and has been in not very diverse newsrooms for the majority of my career, we need more people of color in newsrooms so that we can represent communities who otherwise wouldn't have voices.
It's the most important point of this, you know, whole conversation, is that diversity is not just the spice of life, it's the fabric of this country. It is built on the backs of every single one of us and what each one of us and our cultures and our histories and our lived experiences bring to the table. You cannot pretend to be able to know the ins and outs of your community if you don't have people from every single part of that community represented in the room, reminding you where to look, what questions to ask, and what ways to better do the coverage that's sensitive, because they understand the people who they're talking about. They're their families and their friends. That's vitally important to fair, honest, representative coverage and buy-in from the community. If you've got us in the room, we speak to our communities in a big way. And does that mean that only Latino journalists can talk about Latino issues? Of course not. But often, if it's not your lived experience, you wouldn't even know where to begin in terms of asking the questions or looking for the people in the community who would talk to you. We'll get the buy-in and we can help spread the gospel in the newsroom about where you should look, what stones to turn over. And that can be a group effort if we're represented in the room. We have to reflect the issues of our communities, not just the white community, not just an upper class community, but every single person who contributes to the fabric of the community needs to also be represented on the news. And it's extremely important to remember too, that if we do live in a bubble that is limited to who we live next door to, go to work with, go to church with, go to after school programs with, or see at the grocery store, in a place like Colorado, it's possible to live in the bubble where, because the state is nearly 70% white, your bubble truly is only your white counterparts. And if what we're exposing those people who turn on the TV to is negative stories, crime-ridden stories, that characterize these communities in one particular way, then we're also not being honest or fair or nearly representative of what those communities just down the street are bringing to the table or out there doing on a day-to-day basis.
It's so surprising that a state like Colorado, hey, let's legalize anything under the sun. And it's like, oh, but by the way, let's not prop up people of color in our newsroom.
You're really resonating with a point that a lot of people in the Denver market have made, which is, you know, how can a pretty liberal state and also a pretty liberal newsroom get away with something like this, or even want to perpetuate something like this? It's one thing to say you're woke. It's another thing to be woke. And it's not lost on me that viewership and money may not necessarily come from the Black or Brown communities of Denver and the metro area. I don't know what vested interests go into why you do or don't talk about a community more or less. But what I do know is if you're the white majority of the newsroom in Nine News, you would be, yeah. I can understand not wanting to change things up, because if it's working for you and it's working for them, you know, why rock the boat? I'm not sure that it poses a threat. So that's the part I don't understand. But in terms of doing it the way it's always been done, I mean, that's what's going on there. And I can understand not wanting to change it if it's working for you. It's just, it's not working for us. And the problem is, in a newsroom like that, us doesn't hold the same value. And when you can change that inherently, then you can start making the fact that we're uncomfortable matter, not just because it's good PR, but because it's good humanity to make sure that people are treated well across the board, no matter what color or background they come from.
Yeah, you're Texas born and raised?
Yeah.
Southern Methodist University, I think, what, 2016, class of 2016?
Yeah.
So how did your family, and I'm leading this somewhere, but how did your family end up in Texas?
I was actually born in Louisiana, but I was only there, you know, very short amount of time. My dad's side of the family came from Mexico. His dad and his mom brought them to Louisiana to plant a church. My grandpa was a pastor. My dad was also a pastor. And then my mom is from Ecuador, and she and her mom came over to the States when she was a teenager, and they met in Louisiana. They started having us very young, and they were married way too young in their teens. And I mean, by the time my parents were 30, they had all five of us. They moved to Texas because my dad wanted to go to school. And so he put himself through college while we were in Texas. And my mom was also going back to school. So she's a nurse now. And my dad was getting, you know, something for his pastoral master's, something or another. I was very young, regardless, the university and the scholarships that he was afforded there in Waxahachie, Texas. Southwestern Assemblies of God was what really ultimately brought us to Texas. I don't know if the intention was to stay, but, you know, moving is brutal, and then you had like five children running
moving
around.
I can't imagine doing anything.
Exactly. So I mean, I don't enjoy doing it, and I'm alone. But you add five kids to any equation, I'm like, we're just never ever going anywhere. So you know, we were in a small Texas town, and it ended up just being the right place for us to grow as a family, and it was a great place to grow up. But that's what kind of brought us to these random parts where we ended up.
Traditionally speaking, immigrant families, you keep your heads down, you work, you don't make waves, you don't say anything, you just do as you're asked. What were the conversations like with your parents as you know your contract is not going to be renewed? You've got this experience going on at Nine News. You're going to write this piece for Westword. What were the conversations like with your parents? Were they supportive?
Very, very little was discussed in advance. In fact, I got a message from my mom yesterday, who was listening back to one of my interviews from this week. And she said, you know, I paused it because I wanted to write you this right now, because this is on my mind. You're talking about how afraid you were before doing this. And I talked to your sisters in the days leading up to you handing in your piece. And I had said I wasn't going to talk to you. Like, I was going to make sure that I didn't speak to you in the days leading up to it, because I was scared. My fear and my worry for you would make you more nervous than I knew you already were. And I didn't want to influence you like that, but I was scared I would tell you not to do it. And I didn't want to tell you not to do something. And that was nice to hear. But what it reminds me of is that there are people in my corner who advised me not to do something like this out of just sheer love and concern. And I get that. And I just appreciate that I'm surrounded by the people who I am, who even in their fear for me, knew to let Tiger Lori be Tiger Lori. And I really appreciate that, because that's not easy to do, but they don't put me on a leash. And I'm just really blessed by that. But it's not lost on me that this was not just hard for me.
Yeah, the idea of if they put you on a leash, they're just going to end up having to buy a new one, because you're just going to chew through the one that they try to put you in.
or lose their hand, which they're like, you know, I got so much work to do. Like, I don't have time for that.
So now here's the thing I wanted to talk about. You brought this up, the idea that Nine News was not your first newsroom. So you go back to Bakersfield, KGET, where it is certainly not anywhere in the Central Valley is certainly not, you know, 70% white like Colorado would be. I worked in Fresno for 3 years. Yeah. I grew up and I was born in Visalia. I was going there, you know, every summer. So I'm very familiar with the Central Valley and very familiar with the Bakersfield news product. The idea that you go to Nine News and you're like, wait a minute, this is nothing like what I just experienced in Bakersfield. Talk about those differences.
I mean, Aaron, the best example I can give you is my first giant story was in Bakersfield, was within like a week maybe of being there. And I got it because I could speak Spanish. I was surrounded by reporters who were trying to get into this family's home to get an interview with them. This, you know, big OIS situation happened. Nobody could understand the details of it. Nobody was telling us anything. Yeah. And at the end of the night, we're watching the police press conference, me and my camera guy, Chuck Dennis, from inside the family's living room with them. They're offering us the food around the table. They've just lost a grandfather and a husband. And a father, and we're the ones watching the police address the situation from within the house. I mean, I saw the value of being diverse, and my newsroom held that up the second that I walked in the room. That was not unique. My news director put his home video camera in my hand because I was taking a trip back to Ecuador a year after the earthquake that I had been there for. And he said, well, just take my camera and see if you get any interviews, just see what you get. And he made an Emmy award-winning journalist out of me. And it was my first documentary. He made me an international reporter because of that faith in me. And there was not buy-in to the Ecuador earthquake in Bakersfield, Kern County. But I mean, people cared about me and my newsroom cared about me. So they were bought into what I cared about. And 30-minute special blew out the 6 o'clock news. I didn't just come back with a few interviews. I think what I ultimately came back with was 27 interviews, and we created a half hour special out of it. And they gave me the space and the time to do that. And I mean, all of those things were my first 2 years in news. I think my very last piece that I did, in fact, I'm certain the very last piece that I did at the station was why you shouldn't tell undocumented immigrants to come to the country the right way, and spoke to people who had worked on getting their citizenship or worked with immigration lawyers on just the uphill battle of being allowed to be in this country as a citizen, and got these people to share their stories about just the years and the money and the time and really the almost impossible task of attaining citizenship in this country. And I think that was like the last story that I was like, okay, bye guys, I'm going to Denver now. And clearly, you know, didn't know exactly what I was getting myself into, but yeah, the dynamic was, I mean, night and day.
I was going to ask if you had heard anything about Nine News prior to that, any of the issues that you quickly encountered.
I hadn't heard of those issues. And when I started bringing up that I was interviewing at Nine News among other stations for my next market, really, I was met with a lot of like, oh, wow, we're really impressed. I'm not super in the news world in that I fell on accident into a journalism career in college, my junior year, second semester, and found my job in Bakersfield, you know, because the news director found my reel online. I didn't really know anything about any like, you know, great newsrooms that are known throughout the country because they do X, Y, or Z. I didn't know anything about like MPPA style, anything. I was just learning as I was going. So when people were acting very surprised or impressed by my having interviewed at Nine, that was really the first I was learning about its reputation. I know now that the journalism world and the news world, you know, looks up to this station for so many reasons, none of which are negated because of what I'm saying. There is solid, incredible, such impressive and impactful work that comes out of that station. And there are people there who are truly among the industry's best. That does not change. But the culture of the newsroom I was not anticipating in any way. And I didn't get any heads up that I should be expecting what I found.
Now, that said, you have, in the last week and a half, heard from people who were in the 9 News newsroom. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, wait a minute. Why? Where was this 2 years ago when I was, you know, letting you know, or I was telling people, hey, I'm interviewing with 9 News in Denver. That's my next stop. Like, where were those comments then?
I thought that I asked Aaron that question to myself a lot during the 2 years that I was at 9. Like, why didn't anyone tell me though? Nobody wanted to give me a heads up. This is crazy. Like, I can't believe that this reputation has been able to continue the way it is, knowing what I'm seeing here.
But then you think about it like, well, wait a minute. What if the people who were feeling the feeling that you're feeling, okay, they felt it before, but they also thought, oh, it's just me.
Yeah.
It's just me. And it only took your piece to make things click in their brains. Like, wait a minute. It wasn't just me. It wasn't.
You are super made to feel, Aaron, too, like the problems you're having are your fault.
Unique to you.
Or do leave you, yeah, being, performing lesser than your colleagues. And it's easy to see why we would keep it to ourselves, because if nothing else, it's embarrassing. You don't want to be in trouble for your work not being up to par. And it's hard to differentiate if your work isn't up to par or if what you're pitching and what you want to talk about just isn't what the newsroom subscribes to or cares to know more about. Those are really, you'll have to have a lot of faith in yourself. And I will say the reason that I could get behind saying something that I did, among so many other reasons, is that I do truly stand by the work of the last 2 years. Again, I am not a perfect reporter. I know that. But what I did bring to the newsroom, the stories, the sources, it was often that if I didn't put a story of mine with a person of color on TV, there would be no other people of color in the newscast. I mean, elevating stories that weren't just about someone who had gotten shot or someone who was getting deported. It was incredibly important to shine a light on community issues that had been going on for so long. And I thought so many times that this were happening 5 minutes down the road in a different zip code, we would have been covering this with such a vengeance for so long, it would not be permitted to go on without us talking about it, wall-to-wall coverage. And yet we are letting stories like this happen. They're in our viewership. They're in our community. This is crazy. And that, I know, brought the impacts of journalism. I learned how to be the most effective results-oriented journalist in the last 2 years. Denver was so receptive to being called out on that platform that when you did it, you saw results. My very last story at 9 was a hospital organization was doing a mass 5,000 person vaccine clinic, and the first one they did had absolutely no Spanish resources whatsoever. And they claimed for it to be a vaccine clinic that was to reach underserved communities, and yet there was no second language, anything right, available. And my very last story was I had called them out, and 2 weeks later, they had fixed it for the follow-up vaccine clinic that was coming for everyone to get their second dose. We got the radio recorded in Spanish and English to tell people where to go and where to park. Every sign was translated. Every form was translated. Interpreters were available all the way from the parking lot through the very end of the process to get vaccinated. That was the result of saying this didn't happen and it should have, and then it did. That is incredible impact of say that there's a problem and then see a result or a solution. And that was happening for 2 years with the journalism I was bringing to the newsroom. And that's why I feel confident in this. I know I'm not a perfect reporter, but effective, I absolutely was.
If you hadn't had such a successful and rewarding experience in Bakersfield, but this experience at 9 was your first, do you think you would have lasted the 2 years?
That's a great question. I don't know if I actually would have been as headstrong in this market if I hadn't seen that it could and that it should be better somewhere else. Because if this was all I knew, I may not have a gauge for how I'm supposed to be treated or, you know, what is good or what isn't good. Bakersfield, you know, is a newsroom. So there were problems. It was hard work and, you know, people are people. But in terms of feeling any of these ways, I never did. And I was supported in the kind of coverage that I wanted to bring to the table. In having had that experience, I knew better than to be allowed to be spoken to this way, for our pitches to be thrown out the way that they were, for these communities to go unreported on. I knew that that shouldn't be happening because of my experience in Bakersfield. I don't know if I would have had as many problems probably if I hadn't had that first market to be my gauge for what should be done in a newsroom. And I don't know if I was really the journalist that I am today, you know, without Bakersfield. So I think it took Bakersfield for me to really have had the experience in Nine that I did. But I mean, I think it's an incredible market for the people who can make it in that newsroom.
Right. Right. What's your advice to students? Yeah, I teach broadcast journalism this semester at Cal State Northridge. We read your article in one of the classes, and actually it's the day that a previous podcast guest, Eliana Capellan, who is actually at KGET now, she was the guest. And as we read your piece, she was like, yep, that's happened to me. Yes, that's happened to me. Yes, that's happened to me. She's already in her second market, but the students that I teach are hoping to, of course, get into their first markets. What is your advice to them?
Find a news director who wants to teach you. School does a lot, and thanks to professors like you, Aaron, it helps to prepare us in the ways that it can. But I say the first market that you go into is sort of like your master's program. You are gonna mess up a lot. And that your first market will catch you and help you, but you need to find a place that will invest. And it's not about being in the highest market. It's not about being in the coolest city. It's really about going somewhere that's going to invest in who you become as a journalist. And my advice is, remember the reason that you're getting into journalism in the first place. This is not to fulfill a lost former Disney Channel dream of your childhood to be on TV. And if that's what you want to do, I know that there's room for that. But for the real journalists, remember that we are the watchdogs for our community. We shine lights on what needs to be spoken about. We give voices to the voiceless. We can make change and impact. It's powerful what we get to do if we know where to look, how to commit, and who to talk to and elevate. We get that opportunity with this career. And I would say, go to a newsroom that will foster that in you, will make you go to the council meetings that you don't want to go to, and will make you, you know, have the conversations that are tough with leaders who, you know, you're like, this is not my beat. I don't really care about this. It's all your beat, because I said I didn't have a beat, and now I definitely do. It's gonna be a learning experience in your first market. So hang in there and know that it's worth it, because the power of what we do is really, really incredible. And we are quite an essential part of our society if we're doing our jobs right.
I want to find out if you've heard from anybody at Nine News, any of your former managers or colleagues who have said, hey, I can't talk to you on the record. I can't talk to you officially, but I'm totally right there with you.
I have not heard from Nine News management. I don't anticipate I will. I'm okay with that. I've heard from a ton of colleagues who are still in the building, who, as you know, have worked there before I was there, and we didn't cross paths until now. I mean, more people who are still in the building have reached out to me than have not to say that they support or have had a similar experience, or that I speak for more than just myself, and that they're really grateful that I did it. Yeah, I would definitely say, I know for certain, more who are still currently there than have not have reached out.
So Nine News is owned by media company Tegna. And just today, and we're recording this on Friday, April 9th, just today came the news that Nine News and Tegna is accused in a federal filing of racist behavior. From what you can tell, is this based on what, you know, your article pointed out, or is it part of a larger picture and it just the timing is the timing?
It actually came down on the 8th. I was getting links to this thing and I was like, what in the world am I reading here? I mean, Aaron, I'm sure you've read it now. You know, this is part of a larger Tegna-wide cultural company issue. And some of the examples among my article included that are listed there are disturbing. And I can say that with, you know, confidence. How will it be received? I really don't know. But yes, this is part of a much larger issue that dates back years and years, shockingly so. But I think the article was so public and unique in that, because I don't know of any of these other circumstances really coming out from the person themselves outside of, you know, like FTV Live or other, you know, sources saying a source told me X, Y, and Z about this person's leaving or what have you. I think the article, because it was from my point of view and I had people who came alongside it who had also worked there, it was sort of like, you can't not do this now with everything else that we already have. But I mean, they had their receipts like ready because this has not been out that long. And that was a lot of issue after issue after issue. So this has been like a long time coming. I think what it is that it's the straw that broke the camel's back type of thing.
Before I let you go, I want to ask, you know, as again, a 44-year-old white guy who's been in media for more than 20 years, what can I do?
What you're doing, reaching out to me, offering young journalists a platform to talk about our experiences, being willing to let this be an opportunity for us to learn and grow and conversate, seeing in me that I'm not angry and that this isn't coming from a malicious place, but that it really is about education, that is incredible. And I appreciate that so much. Everyone, including yourself, who has been willing to take this as an opportunity to learn from each other and to have more educated, more open dialogue about something so important. Keep doing what you're doing, because this does mean a lot to us to get to share what we're going through in our newsrooms and to have an open space to be heard and to be elevated. So exactly this open space for conversation in whatever comes, the fun and the serious. It's great to have these independent platforms like this to be honest and to share with each other things that I know better than you and things that you know better than me. That's the spice of life, Aaron, and I appreciate that a lot.
Did I hear you say that you have four sisters, or you're just one of five kids?
One of five kids.
Okay.
Two sisters, two brothers.
Okay, because you said something about like how your mom was talking to your sisters, but you didn't mention the brothers. I'm like, oh God, please don't tell me she's one of five sisters.
Oh, I know. Wouldn't that be tough on everyone involved?
I have two daughters. Two is enough.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But my wife would tell this story about a coworker of hers who had three girls, and they decided they wanted to try for a boy one more time.
Yeah.
Twin girls.
No.
Yes.
That's a fake story.
Five kids.
Aaron,
don't come
on your own airwaves and be out here telling lies.
I sourced it. It's my wife's story.
No, my wife told me that her friend told her that her friend told her the story about her friend. That's crazy. And that's not okay. I mean, what did they do? Did they just have to carry on with all five?
They just had to carry on. I mean, they don't just start giving them away, you know?
I mean,
what
family and friends, like, put them in a loving home.
Where are you in the, I asked Tyra Majors, also a former Bakersfield reporter. Yeah. I asked her where she is in the hierarchy of all the Majors kids. Where are you in the Lizarraga family?
Middle.
You're just making waves, middle child Lori.
They say that, but I don't know. I think I was like,
aren't you supposed to be the quiet one?
I was the youngest for a little bit before my brother came along. And I think I was always like this. Like, I don't think this is like a product of the middle. I think this is just like innate, unfortunately. Like, I've tried to talk myself out of it many times.
Thank you, Lori. I really appreciate it. I know you've got like a super hectic, busy schedule with 18 meetings a day with 35 people at a time. Thank you very much for this.
No, seriously, this has been so nice. Thanks for being patient with me while I figured out, you know, when you asked me, you were among the first who did ask me to speak up and say something. And at the time I was so nervous because the possibility of, you know, retaliation from my former workplace is still very much on the table. I think it fades daily with the outcomes. But that was really on my mind. When you initially asked. So I was quite hesitant at the time to even say yes to anything. Yeah. So I just really appreciate you being patient with me until I was ready to do this with you. And I've loved this conversation so much. This might be one of my favorite ones so far. You just asked really fun, more sweeping questions. You're a teacher too, which I love that you're molding our, you know, journalists, because I was just, you know, had no idea what I was getting into when I left my journalism school. So I appreciate the work you're doing. Hats off to you. And if I can help in that in any way, speaking to your class or doing anything, truly please let me know. I've gone back to my own J school and spoke many times. I don't know what they'll do in terms of having me back after this piece. I'm not sure exactly like if I made the right waves on that, you know, education front. But if I can do anything and lend any kind of educational hand to your students in any way, I would just be happy to.
Connect with Lori at Lori Lizarraga on Instagram and Twitter. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Aaron Bender. All of this, by the way, is in the show notes. Go to Facebook and TikTok. It's at Aaron Bender Media. You could also follow the Aaron Bender podcast on Facebook and subscribe to the new YouTube channel. All of that stuff is at AaronBender.com. If you have guest ideas or comments, email me, AaronBenderMedia@gmail.com. Be well, everybody, and thanks for listening.